This is like the slightly more formal bit of the evening. So Kaushik and I are going to give a paper. So if you wanted to come forward, we would feel less lonely. You can tell it's a bit more formal. We have our suits on. Thank you. We're going to try and think about and address this question that's on the board. Who do we care for? I'm going to talk for about 20 minutes, and Kaushik's going to talk for 20 minutes, and then we'll move on. So in matters of care, Maria Puig de la Bellas Casa opens her chapter, The Disruptive Thought of Care, with the line, care, caring, carer, burdened words, contested words. I want to think about this question, who do we care for, through the further questions that Puig raises, the question of the relation between care and thinking, the disruptive thought of care, and the question of burden and contestation in relation to care. Firstly, is care a practice of thought, a practice not only captured by its material and affective dimensions? If so, what are the implications of mindful care? Care with a history or memory. For instance, care, as Christina Sharp would put it, that is both wakeful, conscious, aware, and yet chooses to stay in the wake of histories of trauma. In what ways does care itself disrupt thought? Secondly, whom does care burden? And who and what contests care? How does one contest, in a political sense, carefully? What does careful protest, careful revolt, careful disruption look like? Joan Tronto and Berenice Fisher, in their very early formulation, very much cited formulation about what care is, describe care as a species activity that includes everything that we do to maintain, continue, and repair our world so that we can live in it as well as possible. The we gestures towards a generic or a universal reading of care, one that emphasizes the temporalities of continuation, of going on. Who is signaled by this we? And who is relegated outside of this world? And I think Kaushik is going to speak to this more. Are care and rupture antithetical? How do we understand change through the more monotonous and dull temporalities of persistence, preservation, staying, and holding? To open up these questions, I want to say something about the temporalities of care and crisis. In fact, one place to start is the so-called crisis in care. So Nancy Fraser has recently identified the crisis in care as a major public discourse in developed nations in the global north. Care, in her terms, is a set of social capacities, those that are necessary for birthing and raising children, for sustaining and maintaining kinship groups and community connections more broadly, as well as the specific practices of attending to the needs of those who are unwell, who need support for disabilities in an ableist world, are elderly and frail, or at the end of life. The practices she outlines, I would take to imply a willingness to hold together relational connections that are constantly under strain, a form of labor that is ongoing as the connections break and are reformed as the very condition of that relationality. The social manifestation of this form of care goes under the name of social reproduction, the affective, material, and largely unpaid labor that has been traditionally assigned to women and to men feminized through that labor, ramifying along the interlocking axes of class, of race, and of global patterns of migration that are one of the afterlives of the European colonial and imperial projects that we are still living in the wake of, as Christina Sharp will remind us. The powerless care for the powerful, and not the other way around. A leading care with social reproduction, Fraser claims, that the current crisis of care is best interpreted as a more or less acute expression of the social reproduction contradictions of financialized capitalism. Capitalism has its own crisis tendency that manifests in the present strains on care in the global north, deeply embedded in the structure of the social order. On the one hand, social reproduction is a condition of possibility for sustained capital accumulation, given that it feeds on the reproduction of the next generation of consumers and workers, as well as the material conditions that allow capital to extract profit from living labor. On the other, capitalism's orientation to unlimited accumulation constantly destabilizes the very process of social reproduction on which its future is guaranteed, given that care practices tend to be time-consuming, useless, non-productive, repetitive and labor-intensive and run contra to the relentless drive towards productivity and innovation that capitalism promotes. So Fraser argues that in each successive version of capitalism, liberal, state-managed, financialized neoliberal, this crisis tendency is expressed in a different way, but it's never eradicated. From this perspective, care, crisis, and capital cannot get free from one another. Capitalism cannot do without care any more than it can function outside the temporality of crisis. And care doesn't sit outside capitalism, but is bound into its seams, and therefore vulnerable to the logic of both permanent crisis and capitalism without end. So if care is to disrupt thought, it would have to disrupt the thought of permanent crisis, of a capitalism without end, and be able to offer a different temporality in which to think differently. Burdened thoughts, contested thoughts. How are you doing? That was page one. I've got three more. You could lie back like you were in the last session, right, and actually enjoy it. What is the temporality of permanent crisis? In The Stakes of Crisis, Janet Reutemann asks, and this is a quote from her, how did crisis, once a signifier for a critical, decisive moment, come to be construed as a protracted historical and experiential condition? The very idea of crisis as a condition suggests an ongoing state of affairs. But can one speak of a state of enduring crisis? Is this not an oxymoron? End of quote. So crisis appears to bind together two temporalities, that of urgency, a critical decisive moment, and chronicity, a protracted enduring condition. The ancient Greek term krino, she tells us, indicated a process of separation, decision, choice, or judgment. In the Hippocratic school, it originally denoted the turning point for a disease where life and death hung in the balance. Was a point that therefore called for a decision to be made. Reutemann engages at length with the late German historian Reinhard Koselleck and his conceptual history of crisis to show how the term shifts from this idea of a judgment made in a decisive moment to a protracted condition by the end of the 18th century. From Koselleck, we can understand crisis narratives to emerge in the modern period as the way European cultures mark a moment in history so as to establish a new era, a break from the past, and a new orientation towards the future. And we know from many other scholars that European time operates through the enforcement of a particular conception of time that then comes to mediate forms of relating to and representing the world. So Quijano, Mignolo, Chakrabarti and Silvio Federici have all, in different ways, argued that colonialism and modernity are constitutive of one another, modernity emerging not simply through industrialization and the separation of the European worker from their means of subsistence, but specifically through slavery, colonization, and the control of women. So Europe becomes situated at the center of the world in its own imaginary through a particular politics of time. As Roland Velasquez argues, one that affirms the West as the present, the non-European as behind the times, and the present as the only legitimate site of reality. So newness, or new historical times in European modernity, are themselves inaugurated through a diagnosis or a judgment that something has broken down, that the past has by definition gone wrong, the present is suspended, and the future holds the potential to fix it. For Reutemann, Kozelek's project shows how crisis comes therefore to determine what comes to count as an event, its status, its qualification as history, and the basis of history's capacity to narrate itself as history. So Reutemann is interested in the way that critique, or judgment, and crisis are radically bound up together. Historical consciousness specifically means that time is not just a medium in which histories take place, but history is itself a temporality on which one can make a judgment, and therefore on which one can act. The more historically conscious we become, the more we feel in crisis. So Neuzeit, is that how you say it, new time? Neuzeit in German? N-E-U, yeah, is that how to pronounce it? Neuzeit is narrated as crisis after crisis, or in permanent crisis, because of the constant, allegedly accelerating production of both this open future and the utopian hope of its fulfillment. A moral demand emerges to do something now about the ills of the past for the sake of the future, what Kozelek calls redemption within history. The way crisis operates in modern European consciousness is to suggest that a particular crisis, the one one is currently in, like the environmental crisis, the crisis of social care, could be the last great, unique crisis after which history will look entirely different in the future. However, in Neuzeit, the terrible paradox is that we can only lurch from crisis to crisis as the very condition of the contemporary. What is crucial to Reutemann's argument is that crisis narratives themselves cannot produce alternative narratives or histories. Because critique and crisis cannot disentangle themselves from one another, critique cannot propose an alternative narrative without crisis. This is its internal and structural limit. Crisis is the way in which we may critique both capitalism and imperialism, but crisis narratives themselves don't produce change. They produce information, but not a different future. How, then, can we narrate a future without crisis? Reutemann asks, how can we imagine that which fundamentally excludes our judgment, that which calls for no decision? So my question is whether our capacity to imagine that which fundamentally excludes our judgment and which calls for no decision can be thought of itself as a practice of care. Perhaps care is a form of thinking, as Puig points us to, that disrupts thought, a kind of mindfulness or concern that suspends the time of decision. This form of care would open up a very different kind of time from Neuzeit, or would at least pay attention to the kind of time that may be imminent within historical time, that perhaps Agamben points us towards with his notion of the time that time takes to come to an end, or within post-humanist thought represents the time of multi-species interdependencies. Reutemann states, without a non-foundational foundation for political action, we can only have crisis and anti-crisis, not crisis and something else. So something else cannot emerge from the judgment or critique that is embedded in crisis. That is not to say that we should remain blind to things having gone wrong. It is not that the catastrophe that comes under the name of the Anthropocene has not happened, nor that we don't feel to be in personal crisis when, for whatever reason, we can no longer hold all of our mental content together. But if we follow Reutemann, crisis must operate as a non-place in the formulation of that question, what has gone wrong, in order that something else may emerge. So the second part, the last part, is called depressing time. There's a significant body of work now that's emerged in social theory that argues that the first decades of the 21st century attest to the contradictions of both experiences of rapid acceleration in social life, on the one hand, and the simultaneous slow violences, that's Rob Nixon's word, of contemporary capitalism on the other. The permanent and irreversible loss of biodiversity, the great acceleration of resource use in the second half of the 20th century, deep time violence brought about by the delayed effects of nuclear and plastic waste, the injustices of wage slavery, new forms of debt bondage, the temporarily elongated control of subjugated populations, including the systematic use of maiming. From these perspectives, slow violence and rapid acceleration work in tandem in ways that not only wear out particular bodies and minds, but produce new and brutal forms of exclusion from public institutions whose purpose is to sustain life projects, resulting in the now chronic deterioration of the mental and physical health of particular embodied subjects. The Invisible Committee suggests that in conditions they term crisis capitalism, the majority are kept in a chronic state of near collapse. Ivor Southwood talks about non-stop inertia as the temporality of the contemporary precarious labour. And Amy Elias describes our incarceration in the present as techno-duration, whereby, to quote, humankind has created its own version of durational time inside rather than outside the box of historicity. And there are many other articulations of speeded up inertias brought about by crisis capitalism. If the majority, though in unequal and differentiated ways, is depleted by the daily struggle to manage their chronic state of near collapse, then one could at least imagine a collective diagnosis of crisis, one that might then give rise to some form of collective action, a coming together of all those who suffer from the current crisis in the technosphere. A.T. Kingsmith calls for this potential for collective action through the recognition of what they term affectarity. Affectarity, like precarity, describes conditions of insecurity across work and life, but it also attempts to capture the affective regime of different historical eras and the potential within the reactive affects they produce. So activism, Kingsmith claims, has always operated through affects reactive forms. Misery in the 19th century, boredom in the Fordist years, and anxiety supposedly drives activism in the contemporary neoliberal period. Whilst capitalism is a mode of managing dominant affects, Kingsmith argues, keeping populations fragmented and disillusioned by personalizing responsibility for collective crises, so activism needs to mobilize the contemporary affect of anxiety collectively, redirecting activist energies towards interrupting anxiety's dominant construction. In an age of anxiety, the call is for anger to replace fear, collectivity to replace individual anxiety, and anticipation to replace sadness. But how does that sit with Reutemann's notion of anti-crisis? Surely this turn to effective anti-crisis can only lead to more crisis and not to something else. Indeed, I would suggest that this something else emerges precisely through an acknowledgement of what the psychoanalyst Melanie Klein would call depressive anxiety, a capacity to go on knowing about crisis without attempts at manic repair, through fostering forms of connection that consist of holding together love and hate, waiting with, enduring with, staying alongside, through the continual capacity to suspend judgment, not the time of indecision, but the time of suspended decision. Puig, in her discussion of soil time, suggests that taking care of soil, for instance, involves understanding that soil is itself lively and is therefore has its own internal forms of care that we can come to know about. So practices of thoughtful and protracted observation before acting on the land and its processes constitute care time, she argues, through a form of slow, repeated, ongoing observation. Understanding soil time involves a form of passivity, she claims, a withdrawal of the self, but also of identified outcomes in relation to caring about and caring for. I would think about this withdrawal under the term depression, a necessary withdrawal that can respond to the very logic of crisis that refuses to be overturned by strategies of anti-crisis. Indeed, depression may turn out to be a more salient affect than permanent anxiety for understanding the affective regime of late capitalism, both in its debilitating, but also, I would argue, in its reparative modes. The depressive position in Klein refers to the capacity to know about the damage we have done to what we love and depend on, and to mobilize something like guilt and attempt something like repair in a depressive rather than manic mode. What Dana Haraway calls staying with the trouble may entail a capacity to endure crisis through the suspended time of depression rather than to seek to mobilize against it. I hope you're not too depressed now. There's just two paragraphs to go. The British psychoanalyst Donald Winnicott makes a distinction between Klein's depressive position, depressive mood, and depression as illness. A depressed mood can only be felt at the level of the ego if the ego has some rudimentary structure, some psychosomatic unity, or what he calls unit status. If so, then depression can come to have both meaning and value. Within it are the seeds of its own recovery. Depressive illness, on the other hand, represents a failure of the processes that might allow the achievement of depression. Clinical depression is associated with sensations of depersonalization, hopelessness, and futility. They belong to the psychic time that lies outside of the capacity for concern, for things to come to matter to us. And the capacity for concern relates to the fate of our own destructive impulses towards what we love and depend on, whether it does or doesn't survive our psychic attacks. Paradoxically, a patient can only recover from a depressive illness if the analyst can know something about their own depression. If depression can be felt to have some meaning and value, it comes about through experiences of the survival of their own objects, internalized as rudimentary structure or form, for something we could call drive or life. So life form, in this psychoanalytic sense, would take the form of depressed mood as distinct from depressive illness. We need the suspended time of depression in order to stay with the trouble. Now, there is no doubt that to spend time on the psychoanalytic couch is perhaps a preeminent example of a waste of time in capitalist terms. A class-bound, anachronistic practice long past its sell-by date. One that cannot be speeded up, cannot be justified, and constitutes dwelling in an indeterminate, persistent situation that can be experienced as interminable. Sean Nagai's concept of stuplimity, which mixes stupid and sublime, as a description of a simultaneous state of overwhelming excitement and stultifying boredom emanating from the same object, seems to capture the affective experience of living in psychoanalytic time. But I would suggest that the long, ongoing, relentless, wasteful working through of the double yet disjunct time of the analyst and patient's depression may be oddly suggestive for attempts to think about social change as occurring in or through a form of chronic or suspended time. What is useful about thinking with psychoanalysis as a mode of care is precisely the notion of working through, which can only occur through the analyst's repeated reluctance to convince anyone of anything. This lifting of judgment and decision allows a form of repetition that looks like dead or depressed time, the going over and over of the same old things, a practice that is not exactly anti-hope, but is about being in a space that is outside of crisis and anti-crisis, the time, perhaps, of something else. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. I really liked what you said. So the other piece of context is that we haven't heard or read what each other has written. So we're encountering this, we're encountering each other's thoughts for the first time here. But I think there's synchronicity, and I'm going to read as well. So there will be synchronicity and modality as well. Okay. So when I was confronted with the question, who do we care for, the pronoun that demanded a response was not who, but we. Who is the we who is the subject of this formulation, given that there is no singular we who cares? It is in the multiplicity and differentiation of the we's who form the subjects and agents of care that politics and violence and perhaps the promise of justice are to be found. Therefore, I want to begin my remarks today by disaggregating the we who are in question. I do so in two ways. First, by thinking the representative function of the we. We speaks to some notion of the collective. I wish to suggest that we cannot afford to think the question of care, or indeed the question of life, in purely ontological or epistemological terms, without thinking the institutional norms, forms, and structures that give the we a collective representative shape, i.e., there is no vital, unmediated collective we. What I'm saying at the outset is that this question of we who cares for life, when all of these terms are at stake conceptually and politically, requires thinking the question of the state. I'm not saying that all politics of care and of life has to reduce to a politics in relation to the state, and certainly not to the nation state. I am saying, however, that questions of care and life as political questions in the context of actually existing histories and presence of political modernity are unthinkable without a theorization of and parameters for representative governance of something like a state. And the second thing is that I want to situate my remarks out of the global south. The singularization of the we often attaches to the unmarked Euro-American agents of care, including and especially when thinking of the state and of biopolitics. So think here of the entirely European provenance of the notion of the state and of life in important developments of the notion of biopolitics, such as Michel Foucault's and Giorgio Agamben's. What would it mean if the agents of care, those who are engaged in biopolitical care of the population, were post-colonial global southern states who are practicing political modernity in the image of and out of colonial genealogies of European modernity? Can life as a matter of concern and care operate in the same way when considered from the perspective of a quote-unquote global southern biopolitics? My remarks today concern the judicialization of health in South Africa. The judicialization of health refers to ways in which claims to health are made through the law and often sees the higher judiciary intervene to place demands concerning health upon the state. This has happened with increasing frequency and significance in the so-called Global South over the past two decades, with South Africa as an exemplary locale for its occurrence. It has invariably drawn upon discourses of rights animated by interpretations of foundational post-colonial constitutional principles. The judicialization of health is part of a more general contemporary global southern phenomenon of the judicialization of politics, as diagnosed by Jean and John Komaroff. I'm in the very initial stages of a project that ethnographically studies the judicialization of health in South Africa as a process that puts questions of both health and the law at stake. My comments in the time that I have can only be extremely schematic and will allude literally in bullet points to four seminal post-apartheid South African constitutional court cases that each concerned itself with health in ways that explicitly or implicitly put the question of life and of who we care for at stake. These cases are the Minister of Health versus Treatment Action Campaign, the Government of the Republic of South Africa versus Grootboom, Thyagaraj Subramuni versus Minister of Health of KwaZulu-Natal, and Mankai versus Ashanti Gold Private Limited. I can only offer very brief descriptions of each of these cases today. The important point that I want to make and that you need to remember is that all of these cases are underwritten by the fact that South Africa has a constitutionally mandated fundamental right to health as a part of its Bill of Rights, Section 27 of Chapter 2 of its Bill of Rights, alongside other fundamental socioeconomic rights such as to tenancy and water. This is very important to note and to remember, and is something I will return to in my comments. So very briefly on each of these cases. Minister of Health versus Treatment Action Campaign forced the South African government to provide the antiretroviral nevirapine to prevent mother-to-child transmission of HIV. In September 1999, the Treatment Action Campaign pressed for acceleration of the government program to prevent mother-to-child transmission. They were told by the Minister of Health that the government had concerns over the safety and efficacy of nevirapine, in spite of the fact that nevirapine was clinically recognized as safe and efficacious. And this was happening in the context of the AIDS emergency in South Africa and of the AIDS denialism of the Thabo Mbeki government. In 2002, the Constitutional Court of South Africa ruled that its government had not reasonably addressed the need to reduce the risk of mother-to-child HIV transmission and made the government make nevirapine available through its public health program. Minister of Health has to be situated in the arc of important precedents on socioeconomic rights jurisdiction by the Constitutional Court. An important precedent here was the government of the Republic of South Africa versus Grootboom, which was a landmark case concerning tenancy rights. The court determined that tenancy was a fundamental socioeconomic right that had to be granted, in this case, to the respondent Irene Grootboom, who had moved on to private land from an informal settlement because of the appalling conditions prevailing in the latter. This followed the verdict in Thyagaraj Subramoni versus Minister of Health of KwaZulu-Natal, which had advocated a restrained role for the courts. This was a case regarding access to dialysis treatment. Because of shortage of resources, only acute renal failure patients who were eligible for a kidney transplant were admitted for dialysis. Subramoni, who was a chronic renal failure patient, made a claim for dialysis based on Section 27. This was denied by the court, which decided that obligations imposed on the state by Section 27 are dependent upon the resources available to it. Much later was Mankai versus AngloGold Ashanti Limited, a 2011 South African constitutional case that opened up questions of relationships between tuberculosis and mining, specifically the responsibility of mining companies in the case of miners contracting silicosis and TB. Thembekile Mankai was employed as a mine worker from 1979 to 1995. This led him to contracting TB, which rendered him unable to work. The case concerned the specific and constrained policy for mine workers' compensation under South African labor law relative to compensation for workers working in any other industry. So basically, if you're a mine worker in South Africa, you're entitled to less compensation for workplace injury than if you're any other kind of worker. The court concluded that common law should be subject to constitutional control, and therefore Mankai was deserving of damages for the disease that he had contracted in the mines. The constitutional mandate at stake here was not Section 27, but Section 12, the protection of the right to security of the person. So I want to make the following three points concerning some of the questions that these cases raise, as they pertain to life, to care, and importantly to law and to rights as they mediate questions of life and care. First, so the first point contains the question of life and its relation to the question of a life. The positive rights enjoined in the South African Constitution clearly have a mandate for and potential to save lives. And there is no question that a verdict such as Minister of Health was a life-saving verdict. Yet individual lives cannot always be saved. There is the tragic case of Subramoni, where it was deemed that making dialysis available to every single patient who needs or demands it is not a reasonable expectation to have of the state's obligations to fulfill socioeconomic rights. This relates to the situation in Brazil, as described by João Bill and Adriana Petrina, who show that one of the unintended consequences of a mode of judicialization that allows individuals to make health claims upon the state as a matter of entitlement has led both to an increased strain on state resources and to intensified pharmaceuticalization. Apropos of this, Justices Madala and Sachs, in a concurring judgment on Subramoni, insisted that the rationing of health resources is, to quote, integral to rather than incompatible with a human rights approach to healthcare, close quote. Even those who won important constitutional cases around socioeconomic rights did not always live to see the fruits of their legal victories. Irene Grootboom, who won her case, died before she could enjoy the rights she had been granted, even as the Grootboom verdict provided the precedent that made Minister of Health possible. Before Mankai could receive the compensation that he had awarded, he died. Even as the Mankai verdict itself provided vital precedents, including that constitutional law can be brought directly to bear upon corporate entities to provide delictual damages to individuals. This has formed the basis for a major class action suit that is currently being settled in South Africa between miners who have contracted tuberculosis or silicosis since 1965 or their widows, and 40 of the major national and multinational mining companies. Hence the question of who we care for threads complex and poignant questions of individual and collective subjects of care and of justice. Second, there is the comparative question of life as an object of rights-based constitutionalism. The verdict in Subramoni, for instance, invoked Section 27, the right to health. It specifically did not invoke Section 11, the right to life, even though the plaintiff invoked both sections in his prayer to the court. In contrast, the Indian Constitution does not have an explicit right to health, which has resulted in the higher judiciary in seminal verdicts, often interpreting a right to health through Article 21, which guarantees the right to life. The South African Constitutional Court specifically refused to decide Subramoni in terms of right to life, claiming that Section 11 issues primarily emerge in the context of capital punishment and not in relation to obligations upon the state. In fact, the comparison to India was made explicit in the judgment. To quote, "Our constitution is structured differently than the Indian constitution. In the South African medical context, right to medical treatment does not have to be inferred from the right to life." Close quote. In a point of further comparative interest, the only medical treatment that all Americans are guaranteed access to, regardless of their ability to pay, is kidney dialysis. This articulates to a very different sacralized conception of life that articulates to pro-life and anti-abortion politics in the United States. Thus, one sees a particular articulation of life as an object of rights to the politics of capital punishment in South Africa and to abortion and reproductive choice in America. In India, meanwhile, life acquires a capacious meaning, becoming the grounds for interpretation of a whole manner of other rights that are not explicitly given. Finally, and third, this leads to the question of how one thinks the differential formulations of life as a subject of law and rights in relation to the global politics of human rights. Scholars such as Didier Fassin, Miriam Tichtin, Peter Redfield, and Robert Meister have made important and consequential critiques of rights-based humanitarianism, showing both their inability to often address structural questions of inequity and redistribution, this is especially Meister's critique, and their ability to function as alibis for imperialist militarism. Yet the genealogies of socioeconomic rights that I have touched upon here point perhaps to different possibilities, including of the rescripting of post-colonial non-imperialist futures. It is important to remember also that socioeconomic rights come out of different legal and conceptual genealogies than international human rights discourse, which, as Meister argues, comes very much out of Nuremberg. I wish here to conceptualize rights as catachrestic. Catachresis, as elaborated by Jacques Derrida, speaks on the one hand and essentially to a misuse or abuse of a word or concept. This is especially relevant to thinking the movement of a concept from one context to another. I argue that rights-based politics in the global south see rights function catachrestically. This alludes, on the other hand, to a related sense of catachresis as referring to the original incompleteness of a word, metaphor, or concept. In other words, rights, in its Euro-American provenance, out of its Euro-American genealogies, is not a closed concept. It comes to be at stake, both conceptually and politically, in its global southern instantiations. My insistence on rights as catachrestic is an obvious argument with a certain imperialist universalism that insists upon rights as foundational to some kind of transhistorical humanism, the absence of which is marked as backwardness. This often couples to historicist arguments that justify various forms of colonial intervention as modernist ones and can be seen throughout the long histories and enduring presence of imperial reason. And think, for instance, of the long history of colonialism that operates all the way from the British colonial regulation of sati in India to the contemporary war on terror in Afghanistan, which operates in part in the name of a universalist female emancipation. And let's not forget that universalist imperialist violence operates often both in the name of and upon the marked female body. It is also less obviously an argument with a certain relativist position that valorizes the radical alterity of cultural otherness and thereby justifies rights as only for us and not for them. And think, for instance, of a certain anti-war position in the Iraq war that certainly emerged in the US that said we shouldn't be intervening in Iraq because they are not democratic societies and we are, even though some of the most consequential movements for democracy in the 2000s emerged in the Arab world. Both positions presume that when rights instantiate outside the Euro-American metropolis, they remain the same. The only thing that changes is the different culture within which they articulate and develop. The universalist position caricatures the difference as somehow backward and in need of improvement, rights as modernizing, even civilizing principle. The relativist position valorizes the difference to the point of fetish, thus portraying a fundamental incommensurability between a rights-based politics and many parts of the world. This portrayal is equally historicist, suggesting a fundamental difference between the West and the rest, while relegating the latter to, as Dipesh Chakrabarty puts it, the waiting room of history. So let me conclude. I am invested in our conversations here to think the question of life as a question of politics. This involves, on the one hand, thinking the question of life from elsewhere, theorizing the question of life from the South. This, for me, is not a theorization of radical alterity, but of the re-scriptings of political modernity from the post-colony. What I'm pointing to, therefore, is not some fundamental or incommensurable difference from Euro-America as the grounds for politics, though, of course, I'm in solidarity with such modes of forging and reimagining the political. I'm inspired especially by the ways in which Marilyn Strathern and Beth Povinelli have both, in related yet distinct ways, taught us to think incommensurability as an essential analytic precondition for thinking of politics otherwise. Rather, I want to think of the inheritances of and dialogues with Euro-American political modernity in ways that provincialize Euro-America while embracing a certain ethos of liberal representative democratic modernity. I feel this is important to do, especially when liberal democracy is under such virulent attack from the authoritarian right around the world. There might well be something to learn about rights for the West in terms of both its affordances and constraints, if only Euro-America was willing to open itself to a non-parochial understanding, not just of how rights function as a certain object of politics in South Africa or India or Brazil or other parts of the global South, but also in how rights are being scripted out of those places. How might we theorize from there? On the other hand, I'm also invested in thinking the tension between life as a collective biopolitical concern and the question of individual lives. The tragedies of the individual lives that could not be saved in spite of the progressive rights-based constitutionalism of the South African courts, the politics of life and death in capital punishment, the sacralization of individual life at the expense of reproductive choice in anti-abortion politics. There are no simple politics here in the dilemmas between individual and collective subjects of care. I also want, as a final point before handing off, to introduce another formulation of a politics of life in relation to individual lives and collective relations, which is Lauren Berlant's of a desire for a life, for a praxis of intimate relationality that exceeds the scripts of a good life that we are given to live by. Tensions between the individual and the collective further map onto complex questions of trans-individual relationality and all the questions of desire, mourning, ethics, extreme love, and radical freedom that are entailed therein. That, however, is not the topic of my intervention, so I'll leave my comments here.